Hello everyone, this is David McGuffin, and welcome to my audio-guided tour of the Roman Forum. Ideally, this audio tour picks up where my Colosseum audio tour left off. However, you're welcome to begin here without touring the Colosseum. This audio walking tour in and around the Roman Forum is designed to be experienced in real time, that is, without pausing. However, depending on the crowds and the queues, you're welcome to take it at your own pace and pause to enjoy the experience. Now, let's begin our tour at the Arch of Constantine on the southwest side of the Colosseum. It's that big arch in front of the umbrella pines on the hill, just southwest of the Colosseum. The Arch of Constantine is one of the most well-preserved ancient Roman monuments in the city. The arch commemorates the victory of Roman Emperor Constantine I in the Battle of Milvian Bridge in 312 AD. But before we talk about the arch itself, let's review why Emperor Constantine I, also known as Constantine the Great, was significant in Roman history. Constantine was Roman emperor from 306 to 337 AD. He was a transformative emperor who shaped the course of Roman history by his adoption of Christianity, his military victories, and the establishment of Constantinople. In 312 AD, Constantine fought the pivotal battle of Milvian Bridge against Maxentius for control of the Roman Empire. According to legend, before the battle, Constantine had a vision of a Christian symbol in the sky and heard the words, "In this sign you shall conquer." The symbol is thought to be the Greek letter Chi Rho, the first letters in the Greek word for Christ. Inspired by this vision, Constantine ordered his soldiers to paint the Chi Rho on their shields and banners, leading to his victory over Maxentius. The victory secured Constantine's position as the sole ruler of the Western Roman Empire. With Constantine's conversion to Christianity, he issued the Edict of Milan in 313 AD and granted religious tolerance to Christians, effectively ending their persecution in the empire and allowing Christianity to flourish. This decision laid the groundwork for the eventual establishment of Christianity as a state religion under later emperors, and significantly it impacted the religious landscape of Rome and the entire Western world. Additionally, Constantine made Byzantium, or that's modern-day Istanbul, the new capital of the Roman Empire, and he renamed it Constantinople. This strategic move transformed the city into a new center of power in the Eastern Roman Empire, or the Byzantine Empire. Constantinople's strategic location at the crossroads of Europe and Asia ensured its continued significance for centuries, serving as the political, cultural, and economic hub of the Byzantine Empire. Later, Constantine consolidated power in AD 324, and he became the sole ruler of both the Eastern and Western Roman Empires. However, in an effort to manage the vast territories more effectively, upon his death in 337, he divided the empire, leaving it to his three sons. This division led to a significant shift in the dynamics of the Roman Empire, with the Western Roman Empire facing multiple challenges and eventually declining, while the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, that is, continued to thrive for nearly another 1,000 years. Okay, let me get back on track here with our tour. This arch commemorates that victory at Milvian Bridge over his rival, Maxentius, for control of the Roman Empire. The arch stands as a symbol of the emperor's military and political success, as well as the triumph of Christianity in the Roman Empire. The arch is adorned with various relief panels that depict scenes from the life of the Emperor Constantine, as well as scenes from earlier emperors like Trajan, Hadrian, and Marcus Aurelius. Many of the reliefs were repurposed from earlier monuments, so although the arch is dedicated to Constantine the Great, most of the caricatures and carved reliefs have nothing to do with him. Now, turn away from the arch and the Colosseum and find the stone-lined street leading uphill between the cypress trees on the left and the Temple Hill on the right. This is the Via Sacra, the Sacred Way. It stretches from here all the way to the base of Capitoline Hill there in the distance. It was ancient Rome's main street, the main drag in town. At its heyday, Rome was home to a million people from all walks of life. Imagine walking through here 2,000 years ago, a foreigner, gawking at the toga-clad Romans shopping at market stalls, bargaining with merchants, wheeling portable carts, and hanging out at the main square, listening to orators, senators, and the everyday chatter of people. Back then, the Via Sacra, along with about 50,000 miles of roads throughout the empire, would have been covered with a layer of concrete and interlocking stones to make a smooth surface for walking, horses, carts, and chariots. What you see today is only the road's basalt stone foundation. The other layers have disappeared over time. Continuing uphill, soon you'll come to a checkpoint where you'll have to pass through a bag check and security and show your entry ticket. Your Colosseum, Forum, and Palatine Hill combo ticket is all you need. After passing through the security barrier, the road splits. The path to the left leads up to Palatine Hill and the remains of the Emperor's palaces. If you have time, it's worthwhile to walk up for a bird's-eye view of the Forum and the new town of Rome. Our tour continues on the Via Sacra. Walk up to the next arch, the Arch of Titus. Titus Caesar Vespasianus reigned as Roman emperor from AD 79 to 81, not quite 2 years. As emperor, he is remembered as completing the Colosseum in Rome and as being benevolent in his relief efforts during the two disasters, the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 and a massive fire in Rome in 80 AD. Before becoming emperor, Titus was a military commander in Judea during the First Jewish-Roman War. In AD 70, he besieged and captured Jerusalem and destroyed the city and the Second Temple. This arch was constructed in 81 AD after Titus's death to commemorate his achievement, and now, almost 2,000 years later, it still stands here today, remaining as one of the most iconic and well-preserved monuments from ancient Rome. Now, move a little closer to the arch so you can see the stone carvings and reliefs under the arch. The arch follows the standard Roman triumphal arch design, featuring a single central archway flanked by two columns on each side. The arch is built using Pentelic marble, a high-quality white marble from Greece. The intricate stone carvings, known as reliefs, show scenes from the Roman triumph after the Jewish War, including the spoils taken from the Second Temple in Jerusalem. Notice the Roman soldiers carrying the sacred menorah and other treasures from the temple, as well as scenes of captives and conquered territories. The Romans were known to show mercy and benevolence to those they conquered. Throughout the empire, Roman subjects were allowed to carry on with their normal life as long as they showed allegiance to the empire by paying taxes to Rome and by worshiping the emperor as a god. For most people, this was no problem because pagans worshipped many gods. The emperor was just one of many. But for the Jews of Israel, who believed in only one true God, it was a problem. Hence, Titus's army sacked Jerusalem, destroyed the Temple on the Mount in Jerusalem, and brought 50,000 Jews back to Rome as slaves. This brutal destruction of Jerusalem caused the Jews to abandon their homeland and scatter throughout the world. Today, we know this as the diaspora. Beyond the arch, you'll find one of Rome's many public drinking fountains. This one, shaped like a big nose, is known as the Nasone in Italian. Go ahead, get a sip, or fill your water bottle. The city is known for its numerous fountains which provide clean, potable water from the local aqueduct system. Many of the fountains have a small hole on the top, so when bending over to get a drink, plug the outlet with your finger and a stream of water spurts out the hole, making it easier to get a sip. By the way, there's a local Roman joke. When a young man wants to take his girlfriend on a cheap date, they say he's taking her to the Nassone. Before walking downhill, let's take a look at the forum from this vantage point. You'll have to use your imagination to piece together this dilapidated, rubble-littered valley and turn it into a shiny, glittering forum of the Roman times. In its heyday, this was the center of Rome. The hill straight ahead in the distance with the bell tower is Capitoline Hill. The hill to your left with the umbrella pine trees is the Palatine Hill. The rectangular valley stretching from the Colosseum behind you to the Capitoline Hill in front of you is the Roman Forum. The Via Sacra is the main street running through the Forum. This valley was filled with white marble buildings covered with gleaming bronze roofs. Each building had a purpose, such as the treasury, the temples honoring gods, the Senate House, residences, public buildings, and public meeting places. This entire valley is known as the Roman Forum. But often, our mental image references toga-clad Romans lounging around an outdoor public square, or perhaps listening to an orator standing on a rostrum. The area where this occurred was known as the Forum Square. You can see it in the distance, beyond the three columns, and to the left of the large arch below Capitoline Hill. It is an elevated area lined with stubs of columns. Now, head downhill to the right of the Arch of Titus. Be sure to watch your step on these ankle-breaking cobblestones. When you reach the first path on the right, take it up to the vast Basilica of Maxentius. We've already heard about Maxentius, the emperor whom Constantine defeated at the Battle of Milvian Bridge outside Rome. He began constructing this basilica in 307, but after his defeat, Constantine took over its construction and, of course, named it after himself. The building was a law court, and an impressive one at that. Its central open area, or nave, was 115 feet high. That's four stories higher than the ceiling of Santa Maria Maggiore on Esquilino Hill. And the arches you still see on the opposite side of the building are 80 feet high. There would have been an identical set of these massive arches on the opposite side of the building from where you entered. Imagine that the lower half of these walls would have been covered with marble, while the upper half was stuccoed. The floor would have been paved with marble in a pattern of yellow, green, and purple. Now go stand at the gate in front of the white church to your right and look back down the length of the basilica. You are looking the length of a football field to the opposite end of this building. On that side, there would have been a semicircular apse, or niche, with a 30-foot-high seated statue of Constantine. From here, this massive statue conveyed the power of the emperor as he literally oversaw all the goings-on in this building. This statue, with its 8-foot-high head, had a remote expression, giving visitors a sense the emperor was far above them and unreachable, a far cry from the accessible republic the Romans had enjoyed a few centuries before. Hey, you may recognize the design of this building. That's because many Christian churches are constructed in the Basilican style. With the rise of Christianity during the time of Constantine, Christians no longer needed to worship secretly to avoid religious persecution. They could now worship in buildings designated for worship. Christians adopted the basilica plan for their churches so that worshipers and converts could congregate in a style of building that they already knew and felt comfortable in. With only a few exceptions, buildings with vaults on the scales that you see here would not be constructed for another 700 years. The construction of massive buildings like this one would not have been possible without Rome's mastery of concrete construction. From the early 100s BC, the Romans used a mortar mixed with lime and a crushed volcanic rock called pozzolana found near Naples and Rome, which allowed the Romans to build on the overwhelming scale you see here in this basilica. Today, many of Christendom's most important churches are constructed in the basilica plan. which comprises a central nave, two aisles, and an apse, as you see in this building. The most notable example is St. Peter's Basilica here in Vatican City. In fact, its architect was so greatly inspired by this Basilica of Constantine that he made the arches of St. Peter's the same width as those you see here, 67 feet. Now, head back down where you came from and turn right when you get to the main path, the Via Sacra. After heading down the hill past the trees, you will come to a circular building on your right with a large door and purple columns. This is the Temple of Romulus. Although it has the founder of Rome's name, it is believed to be dedicated to a different Romulus, the son of Maxinius, who died in boyhood. Notice the temple's two most distinctive features, its ancient bronze doors and the purple porphyry columns. Porphyry is a very rare stone, although you will see it often around Rome. There is only one porphyry quarry in the world, and that is in the eastern desert of Egypt. Its rarity makes this stone worth more than gold. Porphyry is very dense and therefore difficult to carve, making objects carved for this material even more precious and rare. Roman emperors loved to use porphyry on their temples, palaces, and public buildings because of its rarity and its purple color, the color of royalty. Building with porphyry also displayed that the emperors controlled Egypt, an empire that had endured for thousands of years but finally succumbed to Roman rule. Roman emperors would often show off their construction materials like this. Different colored marbles came from different parts of the empire, and those who viewed these buildings were meant to contemplate and be in awe of the far-flung power of Rome. The other notable feature of this temple are its bronze doors. These doors, which came from another Roman building, are original from the 2000s AD, making them 1800 years old. Their automatic lock is still in perfect working order, too. The Romans really did build things to last, didn't they? Now, keep heading down the path until you reach a large temple with a long flight of steps on your right-hand side. This is the temple of Antoninus Pius and Faustina. It is one of the best-preserved temples in all of Rome because it was later turned into a Christian church. In the mid-100s AD, the Senate dedicated this temple to the memory of Faustina, wife of Emperor Antoninus Pius, after her death. The Corinthian columns in green, gray, and white veined Greek marble are monolithic, which means they are carved from one solid piece of marble. This is especially impressive considering the Romans had to ship these columns across the sea from Greece. By the 1100s, this building became the Church of San Lorenzo to commemorate the trial of St. Lawrence, that's San Lorenzo in English, which was thought to have taken place in this temple before his martyrdom in 258 AD. You will often see St. Lawrence depicted as how he was martyred and burned alive on a gridiron. According to tradition, while he was burning, Lawrence joked, "Turn me over, I'm done on this side." This quip made him the patron saint of cooks and chefs worldwide. The church facade you see today is Baroque, dating from the 1600s, but notice where the ancient temple's steps end and the 17th century church facade begins. By the 1600s, when the church was constructed, the ancient steps and a part of the temple's columns were covered by sediment. This shows how much earth has been built up in the area over the centuries. We'll talk a bit more about this later. Okay, now turn around and loop around the green space in front of you to the complex directly opposite the Temple of Antoninus Pius and Faustina. You will come to the ruins of a circular temple, the Temple of Vesta. Here, you are standing at the most sacred spot in Rome. This temple honors Vesta, the goddess of the hearth. The sacred flame which burned inside the temple symbolized the fires that burned at every Roman's home. The ancient Romans prided themselves on their family values, venerating their parents, grandparents, and ancestors with small statues and sacred shrines inside their homes. This temple represented those family values on a large scale. The Romans believed that as long as this sacred flame burned, Rome would stand. It symbolized the perpetuity of the Roman state. Romans were terrified that if it went out, the Roman state would come to an end. The important task of guarding this flame and keeping it lit was left to the Vestal Virgins. The Vestals were the virgin priestesses of Vesta. Six of them served the goddess at one time. The emperor himself selected the priestesses from patrician or upper-class families as girls between the age of 6 and 10. After she was chosen, a Vestal lived in the house of the Vestals for 30 years. The first 10 years she learned her duties, the next 10 years she performed them, and the last 10 years she taught novices. In addition to keeping the flame alight, the Vestals brought water from a sacred spring, cooked sacred food, and polished the ritual silverware in their duties as ceremonial homemakers. During these 30 years, as the name implies, they were bound by the vow of chastity, but after their service ended, they were given a huge dowry and were free to return to the world and marry. The Romans honored and revered the Vestals, who even had their own box seats opposite the emperor in the Colosseum. While it was a great honor to be a Vestal, there were serious consequences for not fulfilling a priestess's duties. For example, if she let the sacred fire go out, the priestess was whipped by the emperor. If she broke her vow of chastity, she was given a loaf of bread and a lamp and buried alive around what is today the Termini Station, and the man was publicly flogged to death in the Forum. Many Vestals and their lovers suffered these fates. Okay, now let's make our way inside the House of the Vestal Virgins. Go up a couple of steps to the left of the temple and enter a spacious courtyard with a rose garden. Around the perimeter of the courtyard, you will notice statue bases and statues honoring the dutiful Vestals that date back from the 200s AD on. A two-storied portico would have surrounded this courtyard. You can see the remains of many of the rooms off the portico, including a dining room, a kitchen, and a mill. Imagine being a Vestal Virgin and being able to escape to this serene and secluded haven after a hard day of work around the Forum. Let's pause to put it all in historical context and talk about the fall of Rome and the scavengers of the Middle Ages. At the height of the Roman Empire, during Trajan's reign in the early 100s, the empire comprised 54 million people from Scotland to Africa and from Spain to Iraq. Roman territory was so large that the Romans simply called the Mediterranean Sea Mare Nostrum, or Our Sea. However, by the time of Constantine, whose arch we looked at earlier, the Roman Empire in the West was dying. Constant wars and overspending had led to significant money shortages, and oppressive taxation and inflation had widened the gap between the rich and the poor. The empire had overextended itself. Romans were unable to communicate quickly enough to manage all their vast holdings. They struggled to gather enough troops and resources to defend their frontiers. In addition, there was often civil war, which plunged the empire into chaos. More than 20 men took the throne in a span of only 75 years, usually after the murder of their predecessor. The western part of the empire was suffering from repeated invasions and had grown weak compared to the east, where spices and other exports virtually guaranteed its wealth and stability. Upon Emperor Theodosius I's death in 395, Rome split into the eastern and western Roman empires. After attacks on the city of Rome by the barbarian Visigoths in 410 and the Vandals in 455, the Western Roman Empire fell completely in 476 AD. The fall is attributed to the Germanic chieftain Odoacer deposing the last emperor of the Western Roman Empire, Romulus Augustulus. It seems fitting that the emperor who saw the end of Rome was named after the mythical man Romulus, who founded the city. The East, always richer and stronger, continued as a Byzantine Empire for almost another 1,000 years until 1453. After the Western Empire's fall, Rome became a backwater. Nowhere was this more visible than in the Roman Forum, which the Romans, and especially the Catholic Church, plundered and despoiled. Today, the elaborate Roman churches we visit with their exotically covered marble are decorated with the spoils of these ancient Roman monuments. It may seem astonishing that the people of the Middle Ages could so freely pillage these monuments without remorse, but we need to look at it from their perspective. After the fall of Rome, citizens were focused simply on surviving in this newly chaotic world, not preserving these now irrelevant monuments. Furthermore, these ancient buildings were pagan, built by people who worshipped non-Christian gods. Therefore, they were considered taboo, haunted by the evil powers of the pagan gods, and deserved to be pillaged and destroyed. The pockmarks and damage the buildings in the Roman Forum exhibit today manifest this irreverence the people of the Middle Ages had for the ancient and pagan. For example, look behind you at the Temple of Antoninus Pius in Faustina. Do you see the deep, angled grooves on the upper part of the columns? Well, in the Middle Ages, Romans wanted to use these beautiful Corinthian columns on a local church, so they attempted to pull the columns down with ropes. Although they did not succeed, today you could witness the damage they left behind. Additionally, after the fall of Rome, no one kept the River Tiber's persistent floodwaters from inundating the Forum. Over the centuries, sediments built up until most of these imposing ancient monuments were covered by earth. By the Middle Ages, the area was no longer known as the Forum, but as the Capo Vaccino, or the Field of the Cows, because shepherds used it as a grazing land for their cattle. The nearby Capitoline Hill was known as Monte Caprino, or the Goat Mountain, for the same reason. There was even a barber who opened up his shop under one of the tallest arches, the only one remaining above ground, the Arch of Septimius Severus. Okay, let's get back to our tour. Go back on the path, that's the Via Sacra, turn to your left and go down some wide steps. Turn right and you'll see a line of people entering the remains of this monument. Enter yourself if you would like. You may see some flowers and coins on a mound on the earth there. Any idea to whom this monument is dedicated? It is a god, but not one you might expect. This is a temple dedicated to Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar is probably the best known of all Romans. His name has been transmitted into later European history as Kaiser and Tsar, and incorporated into the Western calendar as the month of July. He was a great Roman general, best known for his campaign in Gaul, the present-day France. In a civil war, he eliminated his enemies and assumed dictatorial powers. Rome had long been in fear of a dictatorship, and Caesar's behavior did not help, as he appeared in public on a throne and always dressed in a triumphal robe. Although he was popular with the masses because he showered wealth on them, the Senate saw their power slipping away and hatched an assassination plot. They stabbed him 23 times on the Ides of March, that's March 15th, 44 BC. Afterwards, Julius Caesar's body was brought to this spot, and it was probably cremated where the metal roof is today. At the same time, his will was read by Mark Antony. Okay, cue up Shakespeare's "Friends, Romans, Countrymen, Lend Me Your Ear" speech. When Caesar's body was burned here, his adoring fans threw anything at hand on the fire, requiring the fire department to come out and put it out. Later, Augustus dedicated the temple to his great-uncle and adopted father. Caesar was the first Roman to become a god, Let's think about why. Augustus, the first emperor, was trying to assert his power and legitimacy. If he could claim that he was related to a god, that would certainly make a case for his legitimacy. After Caesar, every Roman emperor, or at least those who were liked, was deified in the same way. Anyway, those flowers you see? It's here that Caesar's admirers commemorate the supposed site of his body's cremation with these gifts. Allora. That's a word the Italian is used in the place of or okay. Allora. Now turn left and skirt the forum until you reach a large brick building at the end of the path. You probably will not be able to enter, since the building is usually not open to the public. This building is the Senate House, the most important political building in the Forum. Since the birth of the Republic, this was the site of Rome's official center of government. The present building, reconstructed several times, dates from the 280s. It is so well preserved because in 630, merely yesterday by Roman time, it was converted into the Church of San Adriano. Then in the 1930s, it was restored to the form it had in the 200s. Imagine this building being originally covered with marble on its bottom half and stucco on the top. The impressive doors are copies of the original, which were removed by Pope Alexander VII in the 1600s to the Church of St. John Lateran, where you can still see them today. They are the main entrance to the basilica. This is an example of the famous plunder of the ancient buildings in the Forum. Inside, three broad marble-faced steps provide seats for 300 senators. Here, they would give speeches, debate policy, and create the laws of the land. Still today, many of our laws come from those set down by the senators in this building. Rome prided itself on being a republic. In the BC 1600s, early in the city's history, its people threw out the king and established rule by elected representatives. Each Roman citizen was free to speak his mind and have a say in the public policy. Even when emperors became the supreme rulers, the Senate was a power to be reckoned with. Now, to clear up a little historical misunderstanding. Although Julius Caesar was assassinated in the Senate, it wasn't here. The Senate was temporarily meeting across town at the present-day Largo di Torre Argentina, kind of near where the Campo dei Fiori is located. Allora. Look to the left of the nearby Arch of Septimbrus Severus. There you'll find a low brick wall. This was the rostrum, or the oracle's tribune. It was a raised platform, 10 feet high and 80 feet long, decorated with statues, columns, and prows of ships, or rostra. Nowhere was Roman freedom of speech more apparent than here. From this platform, Rome's orators tried to sway public opinion. Here, Mark Antony offered Caesar the crown of kingship, which Caesar publicly and hypocritically refused. Instead, he became dictator privately. Here, Cicero, a contemporary of Caesar, rallied against the corruption and decadence that came with the city's newfound wealth. Cicero paid the price. Mark Antony had him executed and his head and hands nailed to the rostrum. This rostrum has some seedy history, too. It was famously profaned by Emperor Augustus' sensual daughter, Julia, who used it at night for her notorious encounters. Despairing her incorrigible ways, Augustus eventually exiled her to an island off the west coast of Italy. If the rostrum represents the voices of Roman democracy, the imposing Arch of Septimbrus Severus to its right represents the unquestionable power of the latter empire. Even if you've never seen this arch before, it probably looks familiar. It was a prototype for the Arch of Constantine we saw at the beginning of our tour, and the later Arc de Triomphe in Paris. This six-story high arch, which is still faced entirely with marble, was erected by the African-born September Severus in 203 AD in honor of his 10th anniversary of his reign. The arch was dedicated by the Senate and the people to Severus and his sons Caracalla and Geta, in memory of their military victories mostly in Parthia, which is present-day Iran. You can see relief carvings of the two Parthenian campaigns inside the largest arch. Near ground level are soldiers marching captured barbarians back to Rome for a victory parade. These reliefs demonstrate how Rome's economy was becoming based more and more on slave power and foreign booty instead of on domestic production. So even though you are looking at a scene of victory here, you're also looking at a sign of the Roman Empire's decay. But look back at the inscription at the top of the arch. Do you see the many small holes in the stone? You see, Septimius Severus made his two sons co-emperors, which never worked out too well in ancient Rome. Caracalla, who infamously contemplated making his horse a consul, killed Geta in 212, 9 years after this arch was completed, so that he could rule the empire single-handedly. He then marked out Geta's name on this arch and added words praising himself and his father. Those holes you see up there were made for the original letters Caracalla erased. Okay, we're almost done with our tour. So let's look at the last two monuments for a minute. Turn around and circle the grassy open forum area and head toward Capitoline Hill. Where the path turns right past the forum, look up to see the 8 Ionic columns of the front porch of the Temple of Saturn, up the hill above you. This is one of the oldest temples in the forum, dating from as early as 498 BC. It is dedicated to Saturn, the mythical god-king of Italy. There is still some mystery about this ancient deity, whose name suggests he was the god of sowing, but who is sometimes also associated with Kronos of Greek mythology. Kronos was a titan, the father of Zeus, Hades, and many other prominent Greek, and therefore Roman, gods. The most important day of festivities in the Roman year was the Saturnalia, a festival dedicated to Saturn during which temporary freedom was given to slaves and presents were exchanged. This festival was always celebrated on December the 17th and later came to be associated with New Year's Day and Christmas. The Temple of Saturn was important in ancient times for a very valuable reason. It was the state treasury, where gold and silver ingots and coins, the booty collected by conquering generals, were kept. The treasure was in a room east of the narrow stairway. The holes for the locks can still be seen today. Finally, turn around and look back over the open grassy forum to the Column of Phocas, a fluted Corinthian column. Not only is this a very conspicuously tall feature of the forum, but it is the last of the forum's monuments, erected here in 608 AD. The Byzantium Empire, also known as the Eastern Roman Empire, erected this column, which was taken from an Imperial Roman building, to commemorate the pagan pantheon becoming a Christian church. You know, it's rather sad to view this column because it symbolizes the fall of Rome and the abandonment of the forum, its once grand city center. After the fall of Rome, the city went from 1 million people to less than 10,000 people. Centuries went past, and silt, dirt, decay, and livestock descended upon this valley. By the late Middle Ages, the Column of Phocas was barely sticking above ground. Then, in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, a renewed interest in the history and even tourism kicked in, which promoted excavation and restoration in this valley and all around Rome. So although we must use our imagination to envision what this valley looked like in Roman times, I trust you have gotten a glimpse of the opulence and grandeur through the Eternal City. Thanks for sticking with me today. I hope you've enjoyed our walk through the Roman Forum. A special thanks goes to Molly Silver and Wayne Jacobson for helping me put together this audio tour. Hey, your adventure starts here with David McGuffin's Exploring Europe. Arrivederci from Roma.